All right. Good morning and welcome to the inaugural meeting of the Minnesota House Commerce and Policy and Finance Committee. My name is Tim O'Driscoll and I will be one of the chairs of the committee, and we'll also be joined later in the session by Representative Colley Herr, who will also be a co-chair. And it's my pleasure to have her as a co-chair of this committee. She and I have worked together in this very same room at about this very same time, but on Monday mornings in the world of pensions. And we've been very successful in doing that. And we are also hoping for success with the 20 of us as members around the dais here this morning as well. We do have a quorum, and I thank all of you for getting up at this very early hour of the morning. And the first thing that we have on our agenda today is I'd like to get the members a chance to know each other. I know sometimes in committees where chairs do this, they walk around the table or go around the table and say, I am Tim O'Driscoll, 13B. Well, that doesn't mean anything to anybody. I want this group to be able to work together because we're going to be spending a lot of time together putting bills together and on different topics. And what I'd like you to do is talk about, you know, who you are, how long you've been in the legislature, and maybe the goals that you have, what brought you to be or want to be on the Commerce Committee. Some of you were tapped on the shoulder to ask to be on here. Others volunteered. I don't think anybody camped out in front of anybody's door overnight to try to get on the committee, but that could have happened. So with that, we have the most senior member of the Minnesota House on this committee, and I'm going to ask him to be the first one to go ahead and introduce himself and to talk about where he's from and his background and his goals on here. Before I turn it over to you, Representative and Chair Davids, when you speak, for those of you who have not been familiar with this room, the button that is in front of you on your right-hand side, if you push that button, it's on and off. And so to avoid feedback and different kinds of things, to be able to do that. So when you're not speaking, make sure it's in the off position. And then when you're recognized, put in the on position and go ahead and speak. So Chair Davids.
Well, thank you very much, Chair O'Driscoll. Greg Davids, District 26B, southeastern corner of the state. My district borders Iowa and Wisconsin. I'm in one of those counties where if the senator from Ankeny, Iowa gets his way, they will purchase the lower nine counties. And so my farm is in Fillmore County, so I always wanted to own some Iowa farmland, but I don't know if it'll come to that or not. First elected in 1991. I'm sold that I'm the chair before the Joes and the Tim Wilkin. So it goes that way. So I was term limited out of this committee some years ago, and then went over to agriculture, and since I've really tried to focus on taxes.
Follow-up question for you, Representative Davids. Who was president when you were termed out of this?
Abraham Lincoln.
Somehow I don't believe that's the case, but don't try stand-up. We'll go to the person to your right, Chair and Representative Heisman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Josh Heisman, I represent the Brainerd Lakes area. I have one of the largest chambers in the state, so one of the goals I would like to accomplish is better representing issues relevant to those folks and to make sure that their concerns are addressed.
Very good, and welcome to the committee, Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Max Reimer, I represent Chisago County, 28B is the district, so just about 45 minutes north of here. When I'm not in the legislature, I run a marketing company that works with real estate agents, and we just started a mortgage company 2 years ago. So I would say if I have any goal on this committee, it's to make sure that Minnesota is the most competitive it can be from our small business standpoint, and excited to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Chair Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the members. Representative Ron Kreshaw, I represent 10A, which is covers five counties in the central part of the state. Right at the core of that is Morrison County. Then I go Crow Wing, Aiken, Kennebec, and Mille Lacs. So I go around the big lake. Goals, let's just stop doing stupid stuff.
And then we'll jump over to Representative Elkins.
Steve Elkins, I represent the western half of Bloomington. I'm in my fourth term, three of which have been spent on this committee, and I asked for it.
Thank you. And Representative Faulkner, it's not that I wanted to skip over you. Mr. Simon and Chair Stevenson were like totally in my sight line. I didn't get a chance to see you, but we are definitely going to come back to you, sir.
All right. Thanks. Alex Falconer, representative from Ian Prairie, Minnetonka, 49A. I'm on this committee mostly because so much stuff comes through. Commerce is a first-time member. Just really, this is kind of my master's class, 2 years of just getting to know pretty much every topic possible that we can. So that's why I'm here, why I wanted to be on Commerce. And also, it's my youngest kid, Eddie's birthday today. He just turned 12.
Very good. Welcome. Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Shaw, 47B, Washington County. Largest city in Washington County, and so does 60% of all the business in Washington County, and this is my second term on this committee. Thank you.
Representative Hewitt.
Hi, I'm Representative Hewitt. I represent 56B, Rosemount Apple Valley in Eagan. My interest to this committee, I've been my first term on it in 7 years. I believe the former chair blocked my way onto this committee many times.
So that's correct.
excuse me, Representative Hewitt. If you could just go through the chair, that would be helpful.
I'm sorry, Chair.
You have the floor, Representative Hewitt.
The interests that I have are two big interests. One is the I'm a realtor, so I have great interest in property transfer, stuff like that, and then also payer mix for especially emergency care services.
Thank you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liz Ryer, Eagan and Burnsville. I'm in my third term, first time on Commerce. Prior to being in the legislature, a business career, my clients were health insurers, financial services organizations. I'm a retired charitable gambling manager, so I'm very interested in many of the topics here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Lee Finke, she, her pronouns, District 66A. I live in St. Paul and have Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and a portion of Roseville, and I'm excited to be here. Particularly interested in insurance coverage, pharmacies, other medical access, and making sure that we have an equitable economy for all of our communities.
Thank you, and again, welcome. Representative Katiza-Watoon, former vice chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Carly Katiza-Watoon. I represent most of the city of Eden Prairie, 49B. This is my fourth term in the legislature and my fourth term on commerce. I'm glad to be here, here for consumer protection and many other items.
And the current chair of Children and Family?
Correct.
And Representative Nolan West, who is also on this committee, is the other chair. So indeed, we'll make sure that we don't have a subcommittee of Children and Family breaking out during Commerce.
Look out for us.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So many chairs on this committee. Representative Andy Smith, I represent District 25B, which is downtown Rochester and the surrounding areas. My first term on this committee, second term overall in the House. My wife and I run a small used bookstore, so very interested, obviously, in commerce, but overall most interested that we have an economy here in Minnesota that is both thriving but also thriving for everybody, that everybody can take part in that prosperity. So happy to be here.
Well, welcome. Representative Herr and Chair Herr and former Chair Herr and
thank you, Mr. Chair. Kali Herr, and I'm a state you all know I'm a state representative. I'm in 64A, and I actually represent from the river to the cathedral, south of 94 to St. Clair, and I'm very much interested in this committee. This is actually my first time on it, even though my background, I spent 15 years in the private sector in investments and finance. I come from a family of small business owners, and so this is something that is actually really central and core to my heart and who I am and what I care about. So I'm really happy to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're happy to have you. Representative Stevenson, and chair of, actually, will be co-chair of the Ways and Means Committee as well, and former chair of this committee.
Yeah, good morning. Zach Stevenson. I represent District 35A, which is Anoka, the Halloween capital of the world, and my hometown of Coon Rapids. I've been on the Commerce Committee every term I've been here, and the reason why was because it was the only committee that didn't have any rules, which I appreciated. But sadly, that has come, tradition has come to an end, Mr. Chair. I'm so sad about that. So I'm in mourning this morning, but looking forward to this committee nonetheless.
Well, Representative and Chair Stevenson, I hope that's the only disappointment you have this year with the committee.
Mr. Chair.
We're going to come back to staff. We'll continue with members. The co-chair, Representative Bernie Perryman, and also for the record, Representative Elkins will also be a co-chair as the session moves on.
Everybody better watch out, right, Rep? I'm Representative Bernie Perryman. I represent 14A, which is South St. Cloud, Way Park, St. Augusta, and the east side of St. Joseph and St. Joseph Township. I did ask to be on this committee my first term. This is my second term, so I am happy to say I got reassigned and brought back to the team to be on this a second time. And the reason I joined or asked to join my first term was I've been a business owner for 25 years on the chamber for that length of time, and just see if really to learn what's going to be passed and what is being talked about so that I can understand, learn, have the knowledge, and what does get passed, be able to go back to my own marketplace and be able to help businesses work through what new policy is passed through our committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Perryman. And we'll go to Representative Allen.
See if I can get this thing figured out. Hello, everybody. My name is Keith Allen. I represent 19A, which is about an hour south of here, encompasses the communities of Kenyon, Wyoming, Faribault, Janesville, kind of that long, skinny district. In my personal life, I am a small business owner. I'm a farmer. I hail from a family of farmers and union electricians. And like I said, with my business, I want to try to bring in the perspective of agriculture, because it seems like within commerce, it, much like farming, touches a lot of things, whether it's purchased property, whether it's insurance. It's really kind of critical in the backbone to what happens here in the state of Minnesota, and I want to be able to offer that perspective here in commerce. So thank you for having me.
Welcome, Representative Allen, and we'll move to Representative Dotsoff.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Representative Jeff Dotseth, House Seat 11A, which consists, where I'm from, we don't talk about cities, we talk about counties. I'm from all of Carleton County, Northern Pines, Southern St. Louis. My wife and I actually run a real estate brokerage and a number of small businesses, and also operate a small family farm. And I really believe commerce is really the heartbeat of our state, and it really is important to learn and grow in these committees. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Scott Van Binsbergen. I represent District 16A. I live in Montevideo. Montevideo is about 2 hours and 15, 20 minutes straight west of here. I've been in business since college. I moved back to my hometown, started a business, and I've been in business for 25 years. And, you know, I'm excited to be on this committee. I want to see Minnesota become fairer and an easier place to do business for all Minnesotans.
And Representative and Chair Nolan West.
I'm Nolan West. I represent Blaineham Lake and Columbus in the Minnesota State House. I just had a baby 2 weeks ago, so that's kind of fun. And I have an older daughter, 18 months, and she is the most adorable thing you'll ever see. I am here if you need pictures. And outside the legislature, I have a small business, Best in the West Media, where I do videography and consulting.
Well, Representative Nolan West, you are certainly living the chair that you are of family and children with the new addition to your family. And Representative Patizia Watun, very much a children's advocate as well. So I think the legislature will be served by your service in that area. And one thing that you missed, because you were just a few minutes late, you also had to tell us if you were a tree, what tree would you be? No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding. But I just want to see who's all paying attention yet. So smart. We're going to go to staff, and we're going to go to Mr. Brown.
Morning, I'm Simon Brown. I've been on the Commerce Committee. This is my sixth year on the Commerce Committee. I am committee staffer Chair Herr.
Very good. And then to my left is our CLA. Oh.
Good morning. I'm Karen Hartwig, and I'm proud to be here. I will learn a lot.
In addition to being our CLA, Karen is also my LA. So I'm happy to have her a part of the team. To my immediate right is Jonathan Cotter. Jonathan?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jonathan Cotter. Between the Senate and the House, I do have some prior commerce experience, so looking forward to being back in the commerce world as the CA, the GOP CA for this committee.
And then to finish out those around the table, we have our nonpartisan staff. Ms. Pompu?
Hi, Chair and members. I'm Laurie Pompu, the House Research Analyst that will be staffing this committee, and I've been on the Commerce Committee. This will be my 11th term this year.
Very good. And we'll wrap.
Hello, everyone. Solveig Beckel, House Fiscal. I started with the legislature in the 2019 session, and I cover education finance in addition to commerce.
Thank you very much. And then we have our two pages. I'll ask them to introduce themselves as well. And I, Ben, I'm sorry. Ben, go ahead. Ben Fries.
Ben Fries, House Republican Research. Happy to be here.
Even after the chair skipped over, you're still happy to be here. All right. Now we'll go to our pages. Very good. And if you will just stand up once again and hold your clipboard, that's a nice reminder to me to remind everybody that today and any day that you testify to the committee, you're going to ask to be signed to sign in. That's important for the record. So the pages come running up to you before or after you are done speaking. Please oblige them by providing the necessary information for public record. And so with that, Chair Herr, have I missed anyone else on your team this morning? Okay, very good. Our next order of business this morning is to hear from the interim chair of the Office of Cannabis Management. And is Eric Table here? There he is. If you'll go ahead and proceed to the testifying table and introduce yourself for the record. And today Mr. Table is going to be going through with us information on the department, some policy and some fiscal issues, and then we'll open it up to member questions, and then we'll also, I think, have plenty of time this morning if there's anyone present who would like to provide input for the committee at this early stage of the game relative to the Office of Cannabis Management. With that, Interim Director Table, welcome. Introduce yourself for the record, please, and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Taubel, and I'm the Interim Director of the Office of Cannabis Management. Happy to be here today and talk about some of the work the office has been doing, some of the work we're going to be doing, and then also provide an update or a sort of little bit of an overview of the budget items we're bringing forward this year. When I begin, I sort of want to ground the committee recognizing there are some new faces to the body as well as new faces to the committee and the work that we've been doing and the work that we're going to be doing in the future. And then we'll run through those four budget recommendations we have for operating adjustments, community reinvestment grants, testing facility license variance, and then clarifying some of our social equity license criteria.
Mr. Table, just for audio, I'm going to pull that mic just a little bit closer to you there.
All right, is that better?
Thank you. Man. Yes.
All right. So the office was established in August of 2023. We're nominally charged with implementing Chapter 342, which once fully implemented will cover three sort of distinct work streams within the sort of cannabinoid universe. The first is the adult-use cannabis market. The second is the medical cannabis program. Third is the hemp-derived cannabinoid products. The first work stream, that sort of adult-use licensing process, is running through the office and has since the office's inception in August. In July of last year, we picked up the hemp-derived cannabinoid program, which began at the Board of Pharmacy, then was at the Department of Health, and now has finally found its home at the Office of Cannabis Management. At that same time, the Office of Medical Cannabis transitioned to the Office of Cannabis Management as well, which put all cannabis sort of in the same space. In addition to sort of working through those individual work streams, the office has also been tasked with the process of building an office from the ground up. So this time last year, when the office came to hearings, there were about 9 full-time employees assigned to the Office of Cannabis Management. As I sit here before you today, we now have 90 full-time staff. As part of the implementation work, the legislature provided the office with a Cannabis Advisory Council, which had at first 51 members and now 54 members, who were members of industry, members from public health, government entities, whether it's from a tribal nation or other agencies around the state. This advisory council was tasked with providing guidance and advice to the office as we implemented the adult use cannabis program. You'll see here almost all of the Cannabis Advisory Council members that we work with. This is missing some people. There are vacant seats that we're hoping to get filled soon. This past year, we had 4 quarterly meetings with the Advisory Council. We asked for input from them on things like our testing strategy, our testing regime, as well as some of the cannabis warning labels that will be on products sold throughout the state. We have an upcoming meeting in the next few weeks, and we'll also have 3 more meetings throughout the course of 2025, a meeting later today with the vice chair to talk about agenda items. So looking forward to that in 2025. So the office has undergone a number of milestones in the short 18 months in which it has existed. As I noted earlier, we went from 9 employees this time last year to 90 full-time employees at this point. We also have about 20 temporary staff that we've brought on to deal with sort of high volume issues. At this particular point, it's going to be licensing, as we're about to open a licensing window for adult use as well as medical combination businesses shortly. I would also note that the office was metaphorically building for a while, and now we're physically building, as we have a permanent location for the office where we did some physical build out of offices to accommodate our staff. The office has a requirement that staff come into work 3 days a week. Many of our staff members like to come in more. We found in this sort of startup environment that the ability to walk past a colleague, have an impromptu meeting, has allowed us to triage issues as they come up in real time and really get ahead of problems before they become outsized. The other thing that we've really paid attention to in the past year is engagement with communities and constituencies. Cannabis is new for everyone in the state of Minnesota, and so we've been cognizant of the need to be in contact with those people that are either interested in being in the industry, have an interest in the industry because they're a local government and are going to have to deal with stores and facilities and cultivators and the like, as well as people who have concerns about cannabis, whether it's from a public health safety perspective or from an access to kids perspective. We've launched a number of direct communication strategies. So about monthly, we're holding a webinar, which we invite the public to. Topics have ranged from how to apply for a cannabis license to what the hemp market will look like after we establish adult use rules. And we also had one directed specifically to local governments about what cannabis will look like for them. We've also built out a brand new website that has at present somewhere in the neighborhood of 76 to 80 frequently asked questions. These are questions that come up repeatedly from community that we're providing the answer to sort of ahead of time. We also have a number of newsletters. We have newsletters aimed at general implementation updates. We have newsletters for people who are in the hemp space that need advice on compliance. We have a rulemaking website or a rulemaking newsletter. When we sort of we add up all the sort of subscriptions to these newsletters, it totals about 50,000 unique subscriptions. Obviously, there's some overlap between people, but we have a pretty broad reach with those newsletters. We've also produced a number of guidebooks. I think one of the directives we were given as a body by the legislature was to develop a model local ordinance for cannabis use for local governments to sort of look at as they plan for what they would do with cannabis in their spaces. In addition to that model ordinance, we built out a local government guidebook that operates as a sort of A to Z book for local governments about what they need to do, what they could do, what they can do, what they should do, and we've had positive feedback on that. We've also done a number of engagement events, and in the coming months, our outreach team will be hosting office hours for applicants. So over the course of 3 separate office hours, we'll be having opportunity for people interested in specific types of licenses to contact us, be in direct communication, and get their questions answered. Another big piece of the work stream we've been doing is in the space of enforcement. As I mentioned, we inherited the hemp-derived cannabinoid program from the Department of Health. This program oversees those cannabis canned beverages you see at liquor stores, the edibles you see at grocery stores, maybe your hair salon, interestingly enough, and other locations throughout the state. During the course of the past year, we've done over 3,000 site inspections of people selling these products throughout the state that are currently registered with the office. We've seen a real sharp change in the compliance rate. So when we began this process in early 2024, we were seeing compliance rates around 35%, which is to say on 35% of our inspections, all the products met the statutory requirements. We led with an education to compliance model. So when our inspectors went in and found non-compliant product, our first step was to educate the seller about whether or not these products were legal, and also why they are illegal and why they might not be safe. That model has led us to now about a 75% compliance rate over the last few months, where we're seeing more and more that our licensees are at this stage, our registrants, are understanding the rules of the road. But I will be clear, when it's necessary, the office isn't afraid to sort of flex its muscle and use its authority to bring bad actors into line. The first 2 weeks of December 2024, we actually had an 87% compliance rate. So we're seeing that go up through that sort of education to compliance model. In regards to the medical program, we've seen a sharp increase in interest in the medical program over the last 6 to 8 months. This slide says that we surpassed 50,000 patients. We've now surpassed 51,000 patients. And I think we're up to almost 2,500 registered healthcare providers. So we're seeing a lot of interest in the medical program and seeing it continue. We're working diligently to ensure that people who are joining the medical program have a very quick and easy time getting from that referral into the program so they can access medical cannabis. The other thing the Department of Health and the medical cannabis program did from its inception was have a research focus. And so unlike a lot of states that sort of created medical programs and then just sort of let them happen, our state is focused on what data can tell us about whether or not this program's working. Earlier this month, maybe I think last week, we issued our chronic pain report. So part of our team is research oriented, and they sift through the data of patients who are going in for medical cannabis. One of the common reasons people seek medical cannabis is to relieve chronic pain. And what we found in this chronic pain report is that over a third of patients in the program reported decreased pain. So this is a sort of good indication that medical cannabis is working on these hard-to-tackle pain issues. The other thing this report found that I think is really interesting is that of patients who entered the medical cannabis program with an existing medication regime for chronic pain, 25% of patients either lowered or completely ceased those non-cannabis pain relief methods. And so we're seeing a way in which cannabis can serve as an alternative to either prescription drugs or other pain relief methods. The next few slides really get us into the launch of the adult use market, or the next few bullets. In order to have an actual functioning regulated marketplace, you have to have regulations. And so the first big task of the office was to draft and subsequently adopt rules to govern the cannabis marketplace. In late January, I believe, we posted for public comment our notice of intent to adopt rules without a hearing. And that public comment period closes, I believe, tomorrow, at which point the office will take under advisement those public comments, make necessary changes to our proposed rules, and then move forward with adopting those rules. That is a sort of key first step to market launch, because without rules in place, we can't have an actual functioning market that produces safe and reliable cannabis products. The other piece that we've been working on is obviously the licensing piece, and so we're well underway into a licensing rollout. One of the things that we achieved last session was to implement what we called a license pre-approval process, which before the rules were finished and before we could actually issue functional license, gave us the ability to issue pre-approvals to people who had met the core conditions of licensure, had passed background checks, and were sort of in sort of the catbird seat to be licensed, but could not be licensed until such time as rules were implemented. As you're probably all aware, that process was stopped through a series of litigation, and the office then decided to pivot rather than delaying the market any further to a full round of licensing. Importantly, the office was cognizant of the time, energy, and effort spent by applicants in submitting applications during that license pre-approval process. And so we wanted to pivot in a way that didn't disadvantage anybody or put anybody in a position where they had lost out by trying to get a license pre-approval. So the office offered every single person that had applied at that time the ability to enter into this first round of licensing without additional fee. For those who had been approved to go to the pre-approval lottery, they're now in a qualified applicant status, ready to sort of be taking the next steps towards licensure once rules are in place. For those that are in that position for licenses where there's a limited number, they'll be queued up to go into that lottery. For those who got rejected during the pre-approval, we're going to be giving them the opportunity to correct the mistakes identified by the office so that they will actually be able to, on the same application fee, get into the market either through licensure or a possibility of getting a license through the lottery. We will be opening that licensing window February 18th. It'll run through March 14th. And once we get those done, we'll then start the process again of reviewing applications and moving towards licensure. Finally, we've done a lot of work in the grant-making space. The office was given oversight of two grants. One is a community reinvestment grant that is oriented towards moving money into communities that were directly harmed by cannabis prohibition. These grants aren't necessarily tied at all to cannabis or cannabis-related programming, but rather general programming around job training, community reinvestment, youth services, those types of things. And then we also have a separate grant, the CanGrow, which is a revolving grant fund oriented towards technical assistance to guide people into farming and agricultural careers that are not able to do so now. I will also note, and we'll talk about it more later, but the office has been really intentional about grant program design and ensuring that the grant program we build is sufficiently safeguarded such that any funds that we distribute, we're confident are reaching the people they're supposed to reach and doing the work they're supposed to do. That brings us to our legislative budget recommendations. You'll note that there's four slides after this, and they're pretty small. This is a narrowly tailored focus. We've identified the sort of small things we need to do to make market launch possible. As I noted, this time next week, we will open for license applications. Our rules are currently wrapping up their public comments, all of which is to say we're incredibly close to the point at which we're ready to launch this market. And so what we want to focus on this session is just tidying things up and making sure we have the tools necessary to get the adult use market open. So the first is a operating adjustment to support our regulatory duties. It's a relatively small number. These represent 1.5% and 2.5% of the office's operating costs. You'll note that there's an operating cost increase for the office in fiscal year 27, which reflects additional FTEs that are anticipated coming online for the office at that time as the market grows towards its sort of full maturation. These are really sort of oriented towards making sure we're meeting our costs for the people we currently have in the building, our IT costs, sort of small related costs that obviously, cost is rising everywhere. As I noted earlier, one of the requests we have relates to our community reinvestment grant. So this particular grant is the one that is going to sort of target communities that we've identified as having been harmed by cannabis prohibition. The office developed a pretty cool tool with the partnership with MnGeo, which is a mapping group that allows you to sort of see which communities qualify based on the seven criteria identified in statute. And they're spread throughout the state, and we want to ensure that we have a pretty good reach. But we're also committed to safeguarding taxpayer funds. And so recognizing that we had limited time to launch the grant, our focus has been more on building a solid grant foundation in terms of practices and procedures than it is on rushing to get funds out the door. And what that looks like in practice is that we've worked directly with the Office of Grants Management on not just, what policies are required, but what are the best practices. We also reached out to the Office of the Legislative Auditor to ask if they had identified issues across the enterprise that they thought would be things we should be cognizant of. The OLA referred us to a number of recent reports, as well as reports where they had found both sort of good stewardship and also areas for improvement. We've reviewed those reports and used those reports as we're building out this grants program. This is sort of a front-end approach, right, that we want to make sure that we're safeguarding these funds, we're doing the grant making in a way that is consistent with best practices and ensures taxpayer funds reach the ultimate goal of this body when they enacted this grant program. That takes time, and we've been building an office, adding people, and then adding those people in to build these processes. This week, we went out with the RFP for the first year of the grant, seeking people to submit proposals for the grant. These are smaller dollar grants in terms of $50,000 to $200,000, and we will start to see those come in over the next few weeks. because it is a general fund grant, at the end of the biennium, those funds, if not encumbered and expended, will expire and return back to the general fund. So we're seeking a sort of carry forward for the funds for this year's grant, recognizing that we will have people who will submit an accepted grant proposal that we'll want to continue to work with on their internal controls prior to executing the grant agreement and starting to disperse funds. And so this is really about making sure that people who apply for the grant this year that are approved, that we can get them the funds they applied for, but do so in a way that we think is sort of appropriate and helpful and safeguards those funds. The next piece is tied to market launch. So one of the biggest concerns that we have and have had since we started this this process was that it's not a concern, it's great that every product has to be tested. Customers need to know that the product they're buying is safe, doesn't have heavy metals, doesn't have banned pesticides, doesn't have high content of mold or yeast that would make the product dangerous for human consumption. It's a key part of the market. Having testing facilities in place that can do that is a challenge. And we've identified one of the core challenges to new entrants into the marketplace. So existing testing labs in the state may choose to join the program, and they'll have the necessary certifications. But people who want to join the market specifically to test cannabis will have to go through what's called ISO certification, the International Standards Organization. ISO set standards for testing protocols and practices, and then licenses third parties who go in and certify the labs that they're meeting those standards. The process to get ISO certified takes somewhere between 18 to 24 months and includes a six-month on-ramp where you're doing testing before you even start the process of certification. That's a 24-month lag in testing capacity that could create some backlogs in our products and have product not be able to move to the shelf of our sort of small business owners selling cannabis products because we're waiting for testing. What we've proposed is a variance that would allow the office to license testing facilities that are not yet ISO certified but are under contract with an ISO certification organization to do so, and then build in some checkpoints to make sure they're making progress towards that certification. This would allow us to have increased testing capacity at the early part of the market, while also ensuring that the product continued to be safe. I would also note that the office, as part of its regulatory guidance and oversight, is looking to add some requirements around precision testing review that would require a second third party, at this point like the fourth party, to ensure that the testing protocols are being followed and are appropriate. The third proposal we have is an amendment to the social equity criteria. This is based on feedback we got during the license pre-approval process. So in the statute, there's a couple places where involvement with the police or being arrested or having a conviction qualifies someone as a social equity criteria. A number of people throughout the state of Minnesota were arrested for drug crimes, but in an actual very helpful way, they were diverted from, you know, convictions and direct involvement with the department and provided stays of adjudication. What these stays would allow for is basically you go into court, you say, yeah, I did it, I'm going to admit I'm guilty. The judge does not take your guilty plea and instead gives you 2 years of probation, 3 years of probation, however many it is. And if you meet those conditions of probation, you come back into court and the judge says you're not guilty. And so in that way, you sort of avoid the consequences of a conviction. Those people still went through the court system, have some of the markers of having been in justice involved, and felt like their exclusion from this program was unwarranted or didn't line up with their expectations. Similarly, we saw this for people who had been adjudicated delinquent in the juvenile system for cannabis crimes or cannabis activity, seeking a similar sort of inclusion into this. And so this proposal, I think, reflects that feedback that we got during the process. I would also note that the testing variance, the social criteria change, as well as the social equity criteria and the testing variance don't have a cost associated. There was some cost related to technological changes, but the office is able to absorb those costs, so there's no cost to these. The community reinvestment grant is budget neutral because the funds have already been allocated. And then obviously the operating adjustment is what it is. All right, thank you.
We'll go to member questions. We'll start with Representative West and go ahead, Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, we haven't been able to connect. You gave me a call, I gave you a call back, but then didn't make it. So hello, good to finally meet you, Mr. Talbot. First, I want to say you have a hard, hard job. If you look at the people who came before you, it didn't go so well for them. I know Shirlene Briner did the best work she could, but was unable to see it through. Part of that was she was very clear about not wanting to be the permanent director, despite trying to be forced to be permanent director. So, easy first question. As the interim director, are you seeking to be the permanent director?
Mr. Talbot.
Mr. Chair, Representative West. First of all, I would note that you have a great excuse for the misconnections with a baby born 2 weeks ago. I have no such excuse for not following up. So I look forward to being able to talk with you more about cannabis issues. I chose to come to the Office of Cannabis Management. I filled out an application and went through the interview process and was hired to be the general counsel. I was very happy to do that work. You know, as former interim director Briner always said, this work isn't the work of one person. It's a lot of people. It continues to be a lot of people. I'm happy to serve in whatever capacity I'm asked to serve in, and I think that, you know, my sort of appointment as interim director reflects the work that we've been doing and will continue to do and are excited to do for the people of Minnesota.
Mr. Talbot, thank you for clarification, because when you started, I thought maybe you were going to say, Representative West, I would endorse your your candidacy for that position. I wasn't quite sure where you were heading with that. Follow-up question, Representative West.
I have just a few questions here. So, with the canceled lottery, it was canceled from litigation of, from quite a few different people. During your presentation, you basically said litigation killed it. Was there a certain section or a certain area of the bill? It's my understanding there was, but is there a certain area that caused, that was the target of the litigation that caused the lottery to be canceled?
Mr. Chavez.
Mr. Chair, Mr. West, it's a little hard, I would say, I will apologize for being a lawyer, first off. It is professional training, and so that is who I am. But I will note that the underlying merits of the claims against the office have actually never been litigated about whether or not the sort of decisions were good, bad, or indifferent. The reality that we faced as a state is the same reality that a number of states have faced that have tried to open licensure in the cannabis space, whether it's Illinois, whether it's New York, whether it's any number of states that once litigation begins, it starts to spiral. And one of the things we've seen in other states is that if you have different types of licenses or classifications and one group gets held up, there tends to be a desire to fight to prove that the approach was correct, and then that group gets held up while other groups get to move forward. We thought the better approach was to remove any ambiguity, pull people out of limbo, and just move straight on to the general licensing process to ensure that everyone was applying at the same time and had the same sort of chances to get into the system.
Representative West, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One concern I have with that approach is people, obviously, I would say, argue are harmed when they prepared for the lottery to happen and now it's being delayed. And then just canceling that, I'm not certain, especially if the litigants, you might even create new litigants because they new people have been harmed by the delay of the lottery and then they get pushed into this other lottery round. Is there anything being done to prevent that from being canceled? Because I would argue you're probably going to face more litigation in the next lottery round, and if the strategy is to not do it, well, that, you know, it's a never-ending cycle. So what's being done to close that loop?
Mr. Chavez, before I have you answer, that became a very large issue at the end of last session where we did have a hearing and heard from a lot of folks who had applications that were in process under a set of rules, and those changed, and that resulted in some litigation, as you referred to earlier. But I think Representative West is bringing up a very salient point about the fact that we could face more litigation in the state of Minnesota. And I'm curious to hear your answer, as I'm sure the rest of the committee is as well. Mr. Talbot.
Mr. Chair, Representative West, thank you. I would note a couple things. One is that there were some unique features about the pre-approval process as opposed to our general licensing process. One of the key features was, and it was tied to the reality that the pre-approval process, the benefit provided was time. that it gave a sort of a tranche of time between when we finished that pre-approval process and when the rules went into effect that created the ability to license. So that window is the benefit. That head start is the benefit. Every day in which you shorten the front end, you shorten the benefit, because this timeline was never changing. The office has been consistent about rules being in effect this end of quarter one and launching the market at that time. So as we march closer to that, the benefit decreases. So most of the pre-approval process itself was oriented towards speed in many regards, right? How can we ensure we can process these 1,800 applications in sort of the most expeditious way possible, preserving a system that is fair and impartial. And so our design included things like a triple review for failure. So no one failed because they had one review. If you failed on a criterion, that application got passed for a full review by a second reviewer. And if they didn't fail you on the same criterion, it got passed to a third. But that layering of the approach takes time. And so one of the features of the pre-approval process was that there was no reconsideration method, right? So if your application was denied, there was no petition law office for reconsideration, here's why it was wrong, please give me a second chance. That was statutorily excluded. In the general licensing round, that's statutorily included, right? So if we get to the end of the licensing review and I say, you know, Ms. Leininger, your application is rejected, she can petition the office for review of her rejection to ensure it was fair. That particular issue was especially pertinent for the judge in Ramsey County that heard the request for a stay. There was no order issued, and the subsequent order that was issued called into question his jurisdiction to issue the order. It's sort of an aside, but the thing that clearly gave him pause was a sense that people had applications in that are claiming there were irregularities or problems, and there was no way for them to seek recourse. So that particular piece, I think, is one where we may see litigation. I can't control who sues us. If I could, we would not have been sued so much. But the fact remains I can't. And so we can't control SUSIS, but that's a fact that I think will weigh differently in the court next time because there's an added bit of due process. I would also note that in both the pre-approval statute, or the pre-approval session law, and the general licensing statute, there is a permissive ability for the office to request more information. And so in that pre-approval process, where again, speed was of the essence to preserve the benefit that was time, we said, based on the exact same testimony you heard, there's a lot of people in this state that are ready to go right now that can meet a high standard, a high threshold, and so we'll hold them to that high threshold. And those people that are the most ready will be able to fill these applications out correctly, and we won't ask for further information. That changes in the general round. So now, and we're going to do it for the people that got rejected in the pre-approval, we're going to say, here's some things you missed in your application. Can you address these and change these so we can get you into licensure? Those two pieces are markedly different. And I think if a judge sits and considers whether to stop a lottery process based on one or two dissatisfied applicants, the fact that they will have had a chance to fix their application in the pendency of the application, and then having failed to do so, will get a chance to request reconsideration from the office through an impartial review. We're walling off part of our legal team to have them do the reconsiderations. And so those two pieces, to me, speak to a different environment for legal challenge. And then the sort of final thing I would note is that, and I'll try to note it as sort of without details as possible, since we're currently in litigation about this issue, is that there's an open question at the Court of Appeals about the appropriate body to hear challenges for the Office of Cannabis Management application decisions. I think we'll have clarity on that by the time we get to the lottery, which will also help ensure we don't have what we have now, which is seven suits at two different courts. And in my private practice days, I practiced in complex litigation. And so the surest way to slow things down was to be in multiple jurisdictions, multiple venues. And again, that I think informed the decision making of the office of how is Minnesota best served? Is it best served by making a pivot to launch the market? Or is it best served by digging in and spending more time delaying and fighting to try to get to an answer?
Representative Voss, I'll give you one quick follow-up. The list of members wanting to ask questions is mounting very quickly.
I'm aware. Okay, I'll bundle question with what I would conclude my comments with. So looking at the true party of interest section of the law seems to be a big driver of many of the applicants being denied. And one question was asked the department, which they responded that you can change ownership for these applicants after the fact as long as you go through the Office of Social Equity, maintain the numbers. So you can change ownership after the fact, which I would say makes a something like an option contract incentivized in the way it's written right now. And I don't believe an option contract is explicitly denied. And if I am wrong, I invite House staff to correct me. That true party of interest portion is going to continue to be a problem. And if we want a lottery with less litigation, we do need to, I think we either need to look at it or completely remove it. Looking at other states, Ohio legalized by ballot measure 6 months after we did, and they have over hundreds of millions of dollars in sales. So clearly, we're misfiring here, and both the social equity portions of the bill and the true party interest portions of the bill are chief drivers of litigation. So without those sections, we would have a functioning market today, I would argue, and I think that's a pretty unassailable position. So I would encourage the department to look at how we can fix those things, because it's not going to – it's we're seeing other states blaze past us, and we're still not even to the starting gate. And lastly, just to end on a positive note, the testing portion of your OCM thing is one of the key things that needs to happen, or else we're going to be even worse off even when we get license issued. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Tobel, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, the true party of interest stuff I feel compelled not to speak about because of active litigation. And even though my general counsel is not here to tell me not to speak, I've retained some of those thoughts. So, but I do want to talk about Ohio, because Ohio is really interesting. Ohio legalized by ballot measure, and in that ballot measure had an on-by date, which said they had to have the market up by, I think, September of 2024. Ohio also had a robust medical program that predated the legalization for adult use. And what Ohio did was basically, it's interesting that they're held up as a sort of model of speed, because it took them 10 months to turn on the people that already existed selling cannabis. So their market launched with, I think, 98 pre-existing medical licensees who were given a dual license by the department, the Division of Cannabis Control in the state of Ohio. And then it slowly has added other dual licenses. And so they leveraged their large existing medical cannabis market with an immediate turn on. That's sort of the reality of how Ohio worked. They also had the ability to use the existing medical cannabis rules as they did so. So I think they either have not yet or will shortly start the process of adopting adult use rules. And so in some ways, they're a little behind us, because they don't have their adult use rules ready to go in the same place that we have ours. I also think that Ohio presents an interesting model in contrast to Minnesota, and I don't make sort of a sort of normative statement about whether which approach is right, wrong, or indifferent, but I just note that they're different, that Ohio housed their Department of Cannabis Control in their Department of Commerce and just turned on the medical program. Minnesota, I think, well, I know they didn't do those things. They created a new agency, which is something that almost every other state that gets towards maturity does, is they break that agency out into a standalone agency, recognizing the complexity of the work. And then I think the other thing is that we had a really small medical program. There were two medical providers. I think at present there's 16 retail locations, but for most of the past couple of years, there's been less than 16. And so while Ohio certainly was able to do those sort of things, and that was the approach they took, it looks different than sort of Minnesota's blueprint.
Our next question, member question, comes from Representative Katizawatun, followed by Representative Perryman. Representative Katizawatun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tobel, I've got one quick question, I think, to follow up on the comments on medical cannabis and the market. So it's my understanding, never having been a patient myself, never having needed to access prescriptions for children or anything up to this point, that there are certain different forms of THC and cannabis that is accessible in the medical market that are not accessible will not be accessible in the adult use market. If that's the case, can you just give a little bit more background on kind of how the medical not exemptions, like licensure, is provided, and what sort of back and forth our medical providers may need to do, or what hoops they might need to jump through to sell both on the adult use market and in the medicinal market?
Yeah. Mr. Chauvel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So I think to sort of respond to the first part, there are a number of products that are in the medical marketplace that are designed for patients who are not regular cannabis consumers, like children, so pill forms, things like that, that are probably not viable in the adult use market just because adult recreational cannabis users are interested in more medicinal approaches. And so I think even as we move into sort of an adult use in medical combination market, those products would be allowed in both marketplaces, but I suspect the only place they're economically viable is in the medical program. And so our medical providers will play a key role in ensuring those patients still have access to those types of medicine. With respect to the licensing of medical cannabis providers, they'll be treated the same as every other applicant. We have a medical combination license that allows for cultivation, manufacture, and sale. The application window that we start February 18th will be open for them as well. And we've got a what we call, I think it's like the applicant guidebook that has how to apply for every single license type. That's been updated for this round to include the medical combination business license, which is the primary medical license type, so they have the information they need to ensure that they can apply. The other thing I would note is that for people who want to enter the adult use market but have an interest in providing medical cannabis, we have a series of endorsements, whether it's medical cannabis cultivation endorsement, medical cannabis retail endorsement, that will allow even just like a small retailer to also be able to offer medical products to our medical patients. Timeline-wise, the current two registrants in the medical program are under contract. We're working on a contract extension just to keep that continuity, but we would anticipate they would be applying this round as well for those medical combination licenses. It would be on the same timeline as every other applicant that will review those applications in time, and then once provided license, it's really up to the individual business to operationalize and get going.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cotizo-Watun. Next question comes from Representative Perryman, followed by Representative Ryer.
Hello, Mr. Tobel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tobel, I believe there's 10 total licenses type that are going to be implemented, 6 untapped,
yep,
4 capped. Can you explain the 4 licenses and how many you might be awarding? Is there a cap on each category or a pool? If you can just give an overview of that, please.
Mr. Tobel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So the 4 license types that have caps in statute represent sort of the biggest parts of the supply chain. So that starts at the top with our cultivators, the people growing the cannabis and harvesting the cannabis. And then it goes to our manufacturers who take cannabis and create cannabis products. You know, these are the people that are making the edibles, making the vapes, making all of those sort of products, and then down to the retailer, so when it's actually distributed at the point of sale. The other capped license type is one of 3 vertically integrated license types. Every other license type is restricted to its specific activity with small limitations around combining some of them. But we do have 3 vertically integrated license types. The micro, which is obviously a very small vertically integrated company. The mezzo, which is a mid-size, it's half the cultivation area of our cultivator, and about half the retail footprint of the retailer. So that one's capped as well. And the statutory caps for that mezzo, that vertically integrated one, is we have 100 total licenses to distribute. The first 50 will be available to people who qualify as social equity applicants, and then the second 50 will be available to all applicants. And that mirrored process goes for each of these. So in the cultivator, we have 50 total, split 25 each. In the manufacturer, we have 24 total, split 12 each. And then in retailer, we have 75 total, or 150 total, split 75 each.
Representative Perryman, follow up.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one more question. Mr. Tobel, could you update us on the compacting process you're in?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will let you know that compacting is ongoing. It is a nation-to-nation negotiation led by the governor's office and each of the individual 11 tribal nations that share territory with Minnesota. Those compacts discussions have been going on for months, and once finalized, they'll be made public. Because there's sort of that nation to nation, I'm not really able to sort of divulge much of the content of those discussions, but they are ongoing. And the hope is that soon we'll start to see those first compacts executed.
Thank you, Mr. Tobel. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Ryer, followed by Representative Elkins. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for being here today. You know, I would have been a supporter of cannabis adult use legalization primarily and first and foremost because of the impact on communities that have been harmed by the war on drugs, the inequity that goes with it, and the harm to communities and families. And so I'm really pleased that we have that emphasis. I think it's a really important piece of the philosophy behind our legislation. So my question is about how you are implementing that. Looking at one of your pages, you talked about launching resources through new website, newsletters, et cetera. And I also noticed that you have, I looked at the list of people and experts on minority business development and the like. But it's notoriously difficult to reach some communities. So I'm curious what steps you're taking to be really intentional about that, and also how successful you feel you've been with that and where you need to maybe enhance your efforts. Thank you.
Mr. Tom.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I think it's a great question. And I think, you know, as I noted, one of the things the office has been really intentional about is making sure we're in conversation with all constituencies that are impacted by cannabis legalization and thinking about it from those communities that have been harmed by cannabis prohibition to potential business applicants, you know, to local units of government, kind of anyone that touches the space to think about that. Our director of social equity is part of the statutory requirements. We have a division of social equity. Our director talks about social equity as sort of a continuum and a process, and is very good about reminding us that it's not about just licenses and getting people licensed, but it's about creating sort of a continuum. And so one of the things we're always trying to do is identify communities that have been harmed or that could benefit from, you know, outreach into cannabis. And so, you know, for instance, I know we've had conversations with like the Hmong Farmers Association. We've had conversations with the minority cannabis, the National Minority Cannabis Business Association, locally with the Black Chamber, with the Hispanic Chamber, and really trying to find places where we can, if we don't have access to communities that might benefit from some of our programs, to find those communities and provide access to them and sort of say, here's what we're doing, here's all the resources we've created, and then also just being available to meet and talk about what it is we're doing. And then ways we can make it better or do better in those spaces.
Representative Ryer, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last quick question. What languages are the materials available in?
Mr. Tauber. Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. So I do not know exactly what our translation protocols are. I do know for our application materials, we're available in Spanish and I'll check. I can find this information out, and I'm happy to get back to you. But it is part of what we do is making sure that we are using translation services so that we can be accessible to everyone kind of where they are.
Thank you. Our next member question comes from Representative Elkins, followed by Representative Allen. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I think, an issue that I think Representative West was alluding to in his line of questioning as well. But it was pretty apparent that in the first round of the lottery, that there were parties that were essentially recruiting straw applicants to apply on their behalf with prearranged contracts that if one of the straw applicants were to win, they would transfer the license to the organizer of this. Is this something that we need to explicitly make a disqualifying criteria in the law?
Mr. Tobel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I think based on the office's action, we feel like it is explicitly in the law and that it is disqualifying. You know, we took serious the implementation of the legislative directives we were given, and it was clear to us that the true party of interest provisions were designed to prevent these sort of straw applicants, that we had been warned by by a lot of people that had happened in other states that use similar methods for license distribution, that there were all sorts of, you know, bad actors willing to try to get people into contracts that are harmful or to use them just for an applicant and sort of discard them if and when they got the sort of license. And so we took that seriously. When we were able, when we discovered, we received a sort of tip from an informant that said, we think there's someone who's doing nefarious things in your application pool. We took the necessary steps to investigate, to review the documents, to review the information, and make a decision that we thought was consistent with the law, both as written as well as the intent. And again, I mentioned it in our enforcement section that we educate to compliance, but we're not afraid to use the authority we have. And if we feel like people are intentionally trying to subvert the law, we're going to take a stand. And so I think I'm very happy with the work the office did in that application review to ferret out bad actors and remove them from our application pool.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Elkins, follow-up?
Just an observation. I had an opportunity recently, several of us did, to tour the facility that's being developed at Prairie Island. And I have to say I was very awed and impressed. I mean, they're putting together a full end-to-end operation, which they're trying to do, is a lot of work, requires a lot of expertise, and they appear to have been successful in recruiting some very high-powered expertise from people who had successfully done this in other states. So just setting up one of these operations is not going to be easy for an applicant, and so you're going to have a lot of work to do evaluating these as the people actually try and set them up.
Although there wasn't a question, Mr. Tavel.
No, it was just an observation for the committee.
Mr. Chair, I will say we've had the chance as an office to tour a number of facilities, both of tribal nations as well as the existing medical providers. It's a substantial undertaking, both in the amount of money it takes to build these facilities and the care that's taken with them. I also just would note that I think Minnesota, you know, obviously I can't comment on specifics of the complex, but I think Minnesota will look different than a lot of states in terms of the role the tribal nations will play in our market. And having, I think, you know, partners like Prairie Island who are engaged in this work will help make us a more robust and successful market.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Representative Allen, followed by Representative Stevenson. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Director Tobel, for being here. As I look at the law, it kind of reminds me of something my old man used to say to me. You can't sell apples out of an empty apple cart, especially if you've never planted the tree. As I look at the rules that are coming out, you need product to be able to sell in a retail setting, and it seems like you're running cultivation and retail at the same time. So, what's being done currently to ensure that there's safe product available for like businesses to be able to sell as you're trying to ramp up the cultivation side of it? Because it's just like we can't flip a switch on and grow it like tomorrow without greenhouse facilities and whatnot. So could you elaborate on that?
Mr. Tobel, that is an interesting question because I've also had law enforcement raising similar questions when they've been involved saying, people are saying, well, it's legal. Well, not the way you got it. It's not legal under Minnesota law at this point. So, Mr. Tobel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. It is a challenge, and I think I'll go back to the Ohio example. Ohio is like a lot of states that had pretty substantial and robust programs on the medical side prior to starting an adult use, and so some of these questions just aren't really that pertinent to them because they have existing facilities, they have existing cultivation, they have existing supply chains. We're unique in that we don't, and there's a benefit and a burden. The burden is that it is going to take a little longer for things to get moving. We're trying to be intentional about how we stage licensing to get people into the marketplace so that we don't end up with 150 retailers waiting for products. At the same time, the benefit is there is a little bit of design principles you get to do to sort of try to build a better market and allow, you know, as we have fewer people at the start cultivating, it does allow us to have a little more insight into those facilities in terms of inspections, enforcement, and oversight. I think the reality will end up being what the reality is based on business decisions. There's a number of operators in the space that have found the financing, are ready to go. Some are making plans already even before licensure begins. And so I think we'll see kind of a really mixed bag of people who achieve licensure of able to launch really successfully, really fast, or it takes them a while to get up and running. The other thing I would note is that one of the benefits of the pivot the office made away from pre-approval licensing into this like general licensing is we have, I won't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 190 micro business applicants who are in an approved status, that once we get rules in place, those micro businesses are going to be ready to go. And that's one of those vertically integrated license types. So we may see a large amount of people, a large number of small grows. And so we may have a really interesting market where we grow the market on the back of the smallest businesses to start and start to see brands develop within Minnesota in sort of a unique way. And so I think that's kind of ultimately the answer is that it's it will be a challenge, and we'll try to make smart decisions as we go to stage the market to get that supply chain running in a logical way. But we're sort of in the condition we are based on the sort of reality on the ground.
Representative Allen, follow up.
Well, just given kind of the situation that we're currently in, and there's already entities that are out there that are established and ready to do wholesale, it just seems like an extremely good direction to consider going as far as the market tries to get ramped up and try to meet the need. You know, utilize the existing resources we have to be able to make sure we can get this thing up off the ground and going. So thank you for that.
Do you need to respond to that comment?
Sure, I appreciate the comment, I think.
Okay. Then our next member question comes from Representative Stevenson, followed by Representative Van Binsbergen. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment and then a question. I think Representative Allen raises a great question. I was thinking about that when Representative West was making the comparison between Ohio, and I think Director Tobel kind of indicated that. But I did just want to add one fact. You know, a lot of states that were able to go faster were able to turn on their medical program and make it an adult use program and allow those people to participate. We decided not to do that in Minnesota for a variety of reasons, but I wanted to point out that even if we had wanted to do that, we could not have. I think the report that OCM put out last year said that to meet the demand of Minnesota, we will need 1.5 million square feet of canopy space, 1.5 million square feet of growth. The two medical companies today have a combined canopy size of like 90,000, maybe 100,000. So just not even 10% of what would have been required to supply the state. If we had turned on the medical companies and said anyone can buy there, two things would have happened. Prices would have gone up, way up, and medical patients would not have had access to their medicine, some of whom are kids suffering from seizures and other serious conditions. We wouldn't have wanted that. So it was just not an option for us to take that path. And as a result, it was always going to take longer. I do think that the director's correct when he talks about the impact that the tribal nations will have in this regard on supply. They've been, you know, a lot of tribal nations have been building significant growth facilities. And then the micro businesses are also encouraging. And if you step back, when we talk about what we tried to do when we wrote this bill, we said we want to prioritize small over large, and we want to prioritize Minnesota entities over people from other states. And if you end up with a model that gives a big advantage to tribal nations and micro businesses, that pretty much fits right in with what we were trying to do in the beginning. So that's actually kind of encouraging. The questions I have are unrelated to that, though. The first I have two. The first question relates to the rules that you're in the process of adopting, and I believe that both the draft and the rules that are pending now had a potency cap on concentrates at 70%. And I know I expressed some concern about that when the draft came out, and was hopeful that it would change in the final rules. I wonder if you can talk about that. I just observed that we don't have any kind of potency cap in the liquor market, for example. I'm not sure why we have one in the cannabis world, and I wonder if you're concerned at all that will result in continued gray and black market activity. Mm-hmm. So if you could talk about the review of that rule, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Tobin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. As well as the comment. I will note on the rules that we made a slight change, which was that the initial proposed rules put a cap on all concentrates throughout the market. And what we did was pull back just to the adult use market. And I think What the office was wrestling with in terms of potency caps was public health concerns about the power of high potency products in today's cannabis markets, sort of vis-a-vis the cannabis that many of us grew up with and its relatively low potency, as well as what access points do children have to product? What are the products most likely to fall into the hands of children? And so that 70% just for adult use is trying to cut a balance between products that people are interested in the adult use market, knowing they may fall into younger hands, also recognizing that as we've sort of seen the legalization experiment go nationwide, we're also now starting to see some data points roll in. And for people, I think it's like under 26, the prevalence of first use psychosis is actually, it's like markedly higher than the prevalence of first use psychosis for those over 26 because of developing brains. And then also, as I'm sure, especially those of you who serve on like the family committees are aware, like vaping generally is a pretty substantial problem with youth. And so trying to balance that was really what we were trying to do. We pulled back on the medical side, recognizing that there are medical patients who need those delivery methods with high potency to deal with chronic pain or whatever conditions they might have. But that's kind of the balancing act that we thought about. The other thing I would note is that we generally stayed away from potency limits otherwise for other products. The other potency limit we did put in place was on infused products. So recognizing that infused flower products, infused pre-rolls are very popular in the market now, but they also pose the ability to like get way more THC into a product than might naturally occur. We put a 50% cap by volume on those. And then the only other thing I have a question about, and it's a more rhetorical question, is that I obviously don't know a lot about the liquor limits in the state. I will fully confess to that. But I'm under the impression that there are certain products that might not be for sale, like Everclear, that have that like super huge proof. And so maybe there is some analogy within the liquor market.
That's
sort of thinking an approach.
Sorry, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Taubel, for that answer. I remain concerned about using prohibition as a public health strategy, and I maybe it'll be an ongoing conversation. I neglected to say at the beginning, by the way, and I've said this to you privately, but publicly, congratulations on this appointment. I think it's an excellent choice for OCM. You know, we had a chance to work together extensively the last couple years, and I think very highly of you. I think you're doing a great job, and you're a great pick for this role. So congratulations on that. The other question I did want to ask you is about if you have any insight into what is happening at the federal level. You know, there was an effort in the last administration to reschedule cannabis, and I wonder if you have any insight into what the status of that is, and if you could talk about, if that proceeds, what impact that would have on the Minnesota marketplace.
Mr. Taubel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for your kind words. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the vote of confidence. With respect to the federal level, I think it's really up in the air right now what's going to happen. Both candidates for president campaigned on sort of a prohibition platform, or a ending prohibition platform and a sort of pro-cannabis platform. The DEA pick, as I understand it, is not necessarily friendly to rescheduling or descheduling, and the hearings that were set by the DEA in January have been taken off the books. So I think any sort of idea of what might happen at the federal level is kind of conjecture. I will just note that in the first Trump administration, Attorney General Jeff Sessions rescinded both the Cole and Wilkinson memoranda, which were the memorandum that basically outlined the DOJ's approach to non-prosecution towards states with regulated cannabis markets, as well as tribal nations with regulated cannabis markets. And though those were rescinded during the first Trump administration and not reinstated either during the first Trump administration or the Biden administration, the Department of Justice has shown sort of no interest in cannabis state markets. But I think my assumption is that we're probably in the same state of play we've been in for the past 10 or 12 years there, around descheduling and rescheduling.
And Representative Stevenson, you may have another follow-up, but I'm going to play the counterpart to that, because you and I do really well on point counterpoint on this over the years. My question is opposite of what Representative Stevenson said. What happens if the federal government says we are going to enforce this as a Schedule One? How is Minnesota ready to react accordingly to be able to get in compliance with a complete prohibition or enforcement of current federal law?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I think we've just started to think about this question. As I noted in my answer to Representative Stevenson, even as the sort of prior administrations have maybe walked back some of the Obama era, you know, approach to cannabis states, my general belief is that the cat's kind of out of the bag. I think it's, you know, something like 40 states have medical cannabis programs. Even we were as an office, a number of us were at the National Cannabis Regulators Association, which sounds cool, but it's not, regrettably. It's just a bunch of regulators hanging out in a hotel. So not exciting. But when we were there, one of the things that that I think surprised me was the wide variety of states that were represented there. So met colleagues from Georgia, South Dakota, Mississippi, you know, some states like Virginia where it's a little up in the air. And so I think the reality sort of is that cannabis at the state level is probably kind of here to stay. I think whether or not we ever reach sort of the end of prohibition at the federal level is probably an open question. But I do think it's something that as an office we'll continue to think about and continue to make plans around, because you never know what is going to happen. And obviously we want to make sure that we're in a good place depending on what happens next.
Thank you, Mr. Chauvel. Representative Stevenson, any other follow-ups on your?
No, thank you.
Okay. Our next question comes from Representative Van Binsbergen, followed by Representative Herr. Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, thank you for your information today. It's been very helpful. Appreciate that. My question is kind of back to in kind of your beginning statements. You're forming your office, and you're ramping business up. You've went from 9 employees to 90. Yeah. Just curious about how some of those decisions are made and bringing those employees on, and then where you see the future of your agency. And then also you made comment that your new employees are coming in 3 days a week. Mm-hmm. And just curious, is that the long-term strategy, or do or will there be 5-day work week? Just curious in what they're doing on those days off. Or not, I shouldn't say days off. Days are not there.
Yeah.
Mr. Chauvel, I'll give you a chance to collect your thoughts, because there's a lot of things here, and if you miss something or you're not sure, we'll certainly ask the representative to go back and clarify. Have at it, Mr. Chauvel.
Sure. Thank you, Representative, for the question. So one of the things that I've actually found most exciting about being in a new office is the nimbleness we have, where we can make some changes pretty quick because we're relatively small and be agile. As we've built out the org chart, we've been thoughtful about the needs today are not the needs tomorrow. And so today we need to do licensing. So we have a robust licensing staff. Tomorrow we're gonna need to do inspections, and the day after that we're gonna need to do enforcement actions. And so as we move forward in the process, we're always evaluating where we need people and trying to make decisions that reflect our priorities around public health and safety, around ensuring, you know, market integrity. And so I think we'll continue. You'll continue to see sort of over the years, the org chart will shift and move more towards the bigger bulk being in that enforcement section, so we can be out in facilities, making sure the growing conditions are safe, making sure the products are meeting the standards. I think we've also, you know, one of the changes we made last year was to request funds for a state laboratory. I think we're also seeing the importance of having scientists in the building, of making sure that the decisions we're making are informed by research and science. So that, I think, it's an ongoing conversation. Every time, you know, an FTE opens, I think we're going to look at it and say, what is the best use of these funds to sort of complete our work? With respect to the in-office requirements, that was a requirement established at the outset of the office. And again, sort of reflecting the reality of, like, this work is pretty fast-paced and things change fast and we have to pivot. And so being able to be together makes that a lot easier. I'd also note that we have a lot of inspectors, and so those people oftentimes are just out in the world doing inspections and things like that. Many of our employees also have jobs that, you know, like we have a customer service team who responds via email to questions as they come in. And so most of their work is sort of computer-based. They're in office 3 days a week. But if they choose to, they can work remote and have the sort of capability to securely log into our system and answer those questions.
Representative Vinsbergen, a follow-up?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Representative Herr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Tobel, I just had a question and then one just ask of you. The first is regarding the micro-licenses. This is not going to stay down here. And I appreciate the time that you've spent, you know, going over OCM and everything that it has been through these last couple of years. What I do just have a quick question about the micro-licenses is that, you know, I know that, and maybe I'm remembering this incorrectly, but, you know, with micro-licenses, you can be completely vertically integrated. And I guess now after having toured a number of cannabis facilities, I think it would be really, really difficult for any micro-license to be completely vertically integrated. Where do you see the micro-licenses sort of ending up in that supply chain, you know, once all the licenses have been, you know, approved and we are fully operating in this cannabis market?
Mr. Tommel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Herr, thank you for the question. The micro-license, I think, is an interesting license. And I think I kind of agree with you that I think total vertical integration is probably unlikely to see someone who's going to have a cultivation facility and a manufacturing facility and a retail location kind of all together. It would be a pretty substantial investment. And because of the limited nature of the total square footage of canopy, the limits on manufacture, it might be challenging. I think what I likely see these being is someone identifying a place in the market that could use some sort of specific product. So you may, for instance, see someone decide to create like a branded, you know, joint company, like, you know, Rep Herr's Magical Joints. And so, so, you know, you would sort of really focus in on purchasing cannabis from other growers and then converting them into your product to sell. I do think there, especially in this early part of the market, as bigger cultivators are coming online, there'll be a space for those early with some amount of capital to build cultivation facilities that might supply the market flower products. I could also see someone having sort of a successful small outdoor grow to supplement income and be able to sell into a processor who can turn that into cannabis oil and cannabis products. And then it also is a sort of gateway to retail. So if, for instance, someone is really interested in retail but doesn't want to have multiple locations, they just want to sell cannabis in their neighborhood inside a store instead of on the street corner illicitly, they can get that micro license, open up that storefront, and just retail. So I think it ultimately ends up being something around like a niche market serving one part of the supply chain.
So, Mr. Tobel. Representative Herr, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one ask. So I am still hearing from a number of the SCA applicants, and I know that they've had a little bit of challenge maybe having direct communication with decision-makers. And so my ask is that if we can continue to have that discussion, as you can see today, there's still a lot of questions around the pre-approval process and those particular applicants. I think there's over 600 of them. And so just encourage you. I'm, you know, looking forward to potentially just facilitating some conversations between you and them directly. And so just kind of be open to that. Thank you.
Mr. Chappell, do you want to comment on her comment?
I appreciate it. We will always do our best to be in conversation with the community. We also are trying to ensure that we are consistent with access and don't have any sort of inappropriate meetings with applicants where we don't offer the same information to everybody. And so part of our public outreach program is really making sure that anytime we say anything to someone, we're saying it to everyone as well.
That ends our member questions right now. Is there anyone that has any follow-up questions from the committee? So I have three things I want to do. Take that, take any public testimony today if there are folks who want to share. Then I want to do a wrap-up with Mr. Tobel before we adjourn today. Representative West, did you have a follow-up question?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, first, quick comment. Chair Stevenson makes two very good points. The 70% cap, I've heard, is an issue. I mean, I don't really understand any science, but I've heard it doesn't make it any safer but requires additional fillers, which who knows what they're putting in. So addressing that cap, and both ideologically, as the chair points out, and practically, I think makes a lot of sense. Another thing Chair Stevenson made a very good point on is, and Mr. Tobel did as well, the medical market can't take over because we have a tiny medical market. I would it's very difficult for them to operate as the law is currently written. Is the department willing to look at, I see in your proposal, I didn't see anything that would help the medical operators supply the market early on. Is there anything that the department's entertaining to help the medical market enter? Because as it's written right now, it seems very difficult for them.
Mr. Tobler, do you want to respond to Representative West's statement?
Mr. Chair, Mr. West, I appreciate both comments. Like I said, when the rule comment period ends, we are going to have sort of an internal review and look at all the comments and make final decisions about what makes the most sense. I would just flag that the rules also include prohibitions on certain types of products in those concentrates so that we only have sort of USDA approved food additives in them to try to curb some of the possibility of junk being filled in for the other 30%. And then I think with respect to the medical applicants, we look forward to opening the application window and having anyone who's interested make an application and then working to, if we have applicants who are currently in the market, transitioning them from Chapter 152 into Chapter 342. But I don't believe we have any sort of proposals on the table at this time about that.
Very good. With that, we have exhausted our member questions. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify this morning before the committee on the topic that is before the committee? Mr. Chabal, maybe just have you stay close by in case it's something that we need to phone a friend. Good morning and welcome to the committee, and go ahead and state your name for the record, and we'll just ask you to kind of hold your testimony to 2 or 3 minutes this morning if you would. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Layli Fadahi. I wear a number of hats in this industry, including as the director of MNCAN, which is a public interest advocacy organization that's dedicated to ensuring that Minnesota's cannabis policies reflect the intent of this legislature, the needs of the industry, and the interests of that fought to legalize it. I'm also the president of Qualified Applicants for Pre-Approval Lottery, which I'll talk about in a minute, but it is a organization put together to advance the interests of the 632 small businesses that were cleared for pre-approval and are now kind of in limbo. This legislature worked very closely with stakeholders and advocates to advance a unique vision for a cannabis industry here in Minnesota, one that is meant to prioritize small businesses, social equity applicants, and to create a stable, locally owned industry. And we have grave concerns that this vision is now being undermined by several different dimensions of poor regulatory decision-making, engagement, and implementation. We're at a very critical moment in implementing Minnesota's cannabis laws. We have an industry that is facing uncertainty and dysfunction due to regulatory delays, a variety of agency misinterpretations and decisions, especially ones that are being made without adequate engagement from the very stakeholders that were involved in helping to inform how this market was built. There are two particularly urgent issues that I think require some legislative oversight, and I've been very happy to hear some of these questions and issues being probed at today by the committee members. One of the most concerning issues is the OCM's decision to eliminate the pre-approval lottery on the basis of a court-ordered stay that never had any legal footing, and the Court of Appeals has now lifted, clearing the way for OCM to proceed with doing that pre-approval lottery. The pre-approval lottery was explicitly written into law by the legislature to provide Minnesota's most operationally ready social equity-owned businesses with the opportunity to have an early mover advantage to ensure that those businesses could secure the investments and the local approvals needed to get stood up and to ensure that cultivation could begin on time to provide for the rest of the market. Instead, OCM scrapped the pre-approval process altogether and is now planning to throw those operationally ready applicants into a larger and more uncertain licensing round, basically stripping them of any of the advantages that came with being operationally ready to take advantage of that pre-approval. The decision has already led to litigation. It is going to delay the opening of the market for all market participants, but I'm especially concerned by the fact that OCM has shown no interest in engaging with this cohort of applicants, again, the most operationally ready social equity applicants, to come up with a solution that preserves some of those advantages or mitigates now the harms to those groups, despite the fact that they were willing to make concessions and ease the way for folks that were not successful with their applications for pre-approval. The issue is that Minnesota's cannabis businesses, they can't plan, they can't hire, they can't get investments when licensing timelines keep changing, and especially when it's because of OCM choosing of its own accord to disregard what its statutory mandates have been. So we have these businesses that are now left waiting indefinitely, hemorrhaging money, while we're waiting for, you know, the next round of licensing to happen, where they will be thrown in a much, much larger pool and have a lower chance of being pulled. And let's be clear that this instability, the ones that it hurts again, is the small businesses, the social equity applicants, the local entrepreneurs who risk financial ruin every day as they're waiting for this. Second, I think that there's a grave concern about engagement and accountability in rulemaking and in various implementation decisions. Last year, OCM put out an informal, sort of the commissioner's draft or the director's draft of their rules, and then elicited input from stakeholders and industry members via a series of surveys. We know that response to those surveys was robust from industry members, and now that rules have been published for formal comment, virtually no changes have been made based on that input that came in from stakeholders and from industry members. And our concern is that it's the OCM's reliance on its high-priced out-of-state consultants to carry out the bulk of the agency's work that is further exacerbating these issues. That instead of building a regulatory system that reflects Minnesota's unique cannabis market, the legislative intent, that they're outsourcing critical policymaking to a firm that has no direct familiarity with our state's industry, its existing market dynamics, or the small businesses that they're supposed to be supporting. And as a result, we have these policies that are disconnected from the realities and the inputs of the industry that'll lead to bad outcomes, essentially.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap. There may be some others, and you have some administrative business to take care of here at the end of the committee as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you have a final comment, that would be welcomed.
Yeah, no, these are my final comments are just that, you know, we urge this committee to really exercise its oversight authority to make sure that OCM is carrying out the intent of the legislature and benefiting the industry members and the stakeholders in the manner it's supposed to. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I think you heard some of those comments that you shared today in the comments that members had. And I think you were present at the committee hearing where we had stakeholders in at the end of last session voicing similar concerns. So it is not lost on us, that is for sure. Anyone else from the public wishing to testify before the committee today? Anyone else? Please make sure you check in with the pages as well so they get the appropriate information from you. Mr. Taub, if I could just have you come back for one, probably 2 minutes worth of quick wrap up here, I'd appreciate that. First of all, with the thanks of the committee, it is not easy to sit there for over an hour having 20 different legislators ready to ask and fire off questions with no idea of what they're going to say. So thank you for taking your time and being here with us today. What I'm going to ask on behalf of the committee is we know that we have some deficiencies in the process, and we know that we have some things that need to be fixed. Is there legislation that's forthcoming from your office that we should be aware of so that we can, in our planning, keep that on track and get that moving in a time to be able to shore up some of the concerns and implement this. This topic, as you know and as others know, doesn't necessarily know political boundaries. You have, it's like alcohol and gaming, and then you put this in there. I have made a commitment that although I am not in favor of this and have voted against this, I realize it's here, and I want to build solid guardrails so that everyone is treated fairly in this process. And so that is my ask on behalf of the committee to you. Will we receive corrections coming forward, and at what time do you anticipate we would have those incorporate that into legislation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I've enjoyed it. I'm happy to work together. I think it's important. I appreciate the approach you're taking, as well as Vice Chair Berryman, who are you may not have been cannabis evangelists in the past sessions, but are committed to making sure that our system works for all Minnesotans. I share that commitment. We have some policy proposals coming forward. I will note that our lens this session really is on tight fixes, on making sure that the bill we have makes sense. As I noted during my presentation, we're on the precipice of the launch, and certainly we could tinker forever and sort of make little changes here and there. But the reality is we need to launch the market. And once the market launches, we'll continue to make changes and updates and build the market that sort of is fair for all Minnesotans. As part of the rulemaking process, you know, our team looked at the way other states are regulating cannabis. And what we noticed was the more mature a market was, the more rules and regulations they were, because those rules and regulations reflect experience and knowledge gained over time. And so we're on the precipice of launch. We're trying to get everything we can done in the next few months to launch successfully. And then we'll continue to work to make sure that we're updating and changing the laws and the rules and the regulations and the guidance as necessary to make sure that the market works for everyone.
And do you have a timeline?
Do we have a timeline? I'm told we have jackets on our policy proposals.
Okay.
And I one day will know what that means.
I'd invite you to get together with some of the members and maybe the chairs and vice chairs just to start having a conversation so we can kind of figure out where things are at.
Yeah.
And then finally, it would be inappropriate if I didn't give you a chance as well to respond to the comments that were in the public testimony part alleged against your organization and your agency.
So
if you have any comments, you're certainly welcome to make those at this time.
I appreciate the opportunity. I also appreciate Ms. Fahey's passion for the cannabis bill. And we're committed to working with all partners, all constituencies to do the best we can. Given, as she noted, she's representing pending litigation against us. I'll leave that as my comments.
Thank you again for your time with the committee. Tomorrow, members, we will have Commissioner Arnold and others from the Department of Commerce in talking about their policies and their budget for next year. Seeing no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.